They ended up spending decades and decades behind bars for murders they never committed.
This is a True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. You just heard the voice of Steve Neveling, an investigative reporter for the Metro Times in Detroit. Since 2024, he's been covering the case of Barbara Simon, a former detective who has been accused of coercing false statements from hundreds of black men, leading to their imprisonment. Recently, CNN cited his work in an article about this case. In this episode, we're going to dive into some of what goes into bringing criminals to justice, and also what happens when that process goes wrong. We'll hear from Neveling, as well as officials from around the country, like St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Melissa Price Smith, and a Pennsylvania lawmaker who wants to put a stop to the death penalty. First, we'll check in with some updates on developing true crime cases throughout the nation, starting with the case of Nick Reiner, who is accused of killing his parents, beloved director Rob Reiner, and producer Michelle Reiner. The couple is survived by two other children, as well as Rob's adopted daughter from his first marriage to director and actress Penny Marshall. Odyssey station KNX News has been covering the story since last December, when the Reiner's daughter discovered their bodies dead in their Brentwood home. Here's the latest on the case from this week.
Well, it was another court appearance for Nick Reiner this morning, but we are still actually a long way off from a potential trial. Natalie Tavidian has more from downtown L.A.
Nick Reiner was back in a downtown L.A. courtroom today, but instead of moving the case forward, it was delayed. His defense said they're still waiting on evidence, and prosecutors added they're still waiting on autopsy reports, with more discovery expected soon. So the judge pushed things out, setting another preliminary hearing setting for September 15th. Reiner has pleaded not guilty to killing his parents, who were found dead inside their Brentwood home late last year, both victims of multiple sharp force injuries. He remains in custody without bail and could face the death penalty depending on how the case unfolds. And while the legal process continues, the family is still processing the loss, with his brother describing the moment he found out as life-changing and devastating. For now, this case remains in a holding pattern as both sides continue building toward the next step.
KNX News has also been covering a murder case involving Billboard charting musician David, stylized as D4VD.
Prosecutors revealing some of the evidence that they have against the singer David, charged with murdering 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez. And we need to warn you that some of the information that you hear may be very difficult to hear. Alex Silverman on what the latest court filing tells us.
There are horrifying details in here. And prosecutors actually use that word to describe how they say David prepared for and carried out the murder. They say he bought chainsaws online, knowing he had to silence the victim before she ruined his music career. Very soon after her arrival at his home, he stabbed the victim to death multiple times and stood by while she bled out, the filing says. He then used the chainsaws and an inflatable pool to protect the garage floor, prosecutors explain. The theory, backed up by text messages, is that Celeste, who was 13 when the two started their alleged sexual relationship, was jealous about other women she found out about and threatened to destroy a life and career that had shot to fame with the single Romantic Homicide. After the murder, prosecutors say David drove to Santa Barbara County to get rid of evidence, including Celeste's passport. But within a couple days, he was back in L.A. doing a radio interview about his new album. Then he went on tour. That's where he was when his Tesla was towed and the body was finally found more than 4 months later.
We have gone in depth into both the Reiner and David cases in previous true crime roundups. We've also been following this case, reported on by Odyssey station KRLD 1080 in Dallas. Tanner Horner, a former FedEx driver who has said he has an alter ego named Zero, admitted to sexually assaulting and killing 7-year-old Athena Strand in 2022. Here's the latest on his trial from KRLD.
Prosecutors crossed Dr. Eileen Ryan, who says during a session with Horner following his arrest, he admitted to killing Strand after the little girl saw him do a line of cocaine in the FedEx truck he was driving.
When he put her in the truck, in my opinion, he didn't plan on killing her. It wasn't until he recognized now it's so much worse.
She said Horner admitted to punching, kicking, and strangling the little girl, and then in a shocker, exposing himself to her before she died. The defense is claiming that mental illness and years of abuse requires the jury to give Horner life in prison. The prosecution is asking for the death penalty.
KRLD reported on another gruesome crime this week involving murder and arson allegations.
Police in Carrollton arrest a woman. They say she murdered her husband and then sat on their front porch while their house was burning. Police got a call about a stabbing early this morning at a home on Old Denton Road. When they got there, the house was on fire, and Carolina Marcius told them her husband, Ramon, still inside. Crews with Carrollton Fire Rescue had to come out to the scene. They got the man out, but he didn't make it. Now the wife is under arrest for murder.
In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio also reported on a crime that involves alleged murder and arson.
A woman is dead and a man is in custody after authorities in Camden County say he stabbed her and then set a townhouse on fire. KYW's Nigel Thompson reports from Gloucester Township.
Roy Ramirez lives across Freedom Way in the Independence Townhomes complex from where crews battled an early morning fire in Gloucester Township. He says it quickly became apparent it was more than just a fire.
I was watching from my house. And then when I seen they were bringing out the body and all that stuff, that's when I tried to go see outside to see what's going on. And then we heard the family crying, he's crazy.
After the fire was out, the investigation began, led by the Camden County Prosecutor's Office and Gloucester Township Police. Authorities say the victim is a woman in her 50s and that a man is in custody. The man has yet to be charged in the case.
In addition to that report, multiple crime reports came out of KYW in Philly this week. Here's a report from Monday.
In Newark, Delaware, police say 54-year-old Eric Pitts of Newark has been arrested and charged for allegedly slashing someone's neck with a box cutter. Officials say that Pitts and another person got into a couple of altercations Friday afternoon along the 300 block of East Main Street. According to authorities, this was during the second incident when Pitts seriously injured the victim. The victim has been treated and released from the hospital. Pitts was charged with first-degree assault and the possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. He is being held on $30,000 bail.
And here's another report from Wednesday.
An inmate at SCI Phoenix in Montgomery County has pleaded guilty to third-degree murder for killing his cellmate. 42-year-old Nathaniel Blows is sentenced to 8 to 16 years in prison for beating and choking 45-year-old Sean Harden to death in the overnight hours of October 31st into November 1st, 2024. Now, during a court appearance last week, Blows interrupted the judge to say that he was tired of the ongoing court appearance and admitted to killing Harden. Blows was originally serving a 3.5 to 7 year sentence for firearms violation and for headbutting a police officer in the face in 2020. Harden was nearing the end of a 4 to 8 year sentence for molesting 3 children in 2014.
KYW reported this on Wednesday as well.
One of the suspects accused of shooting and killing a 14-year-old outside a Roxborough football field nearly 4 years ago has pleaded guilty to the murder of 2 teenagers. KYW's Crime and Justice reporter Kristen Johansson the details.
It was DNA from a shell casing that matched Sakir McClendon to the shooting death of 14-year-old Nicholas Alizalde and to the injuries of 4 others following a football scrimmage at Roxborough High School in September of 2022. Prosecutors say detectives also tied McClendon Instagram conversations and phone records talking about the shooting, which they say was motivated by an altercation involving one of their friends. 21-year-old McClendon's DNA also matched evidence in the murder of Nafis Betran Hill, a 16-year-old who was gunned down in April of 2023 at 23rd and Montgomery in North Philly. Another man, Renee Allen, also pleaded guilty. McClendon pleaded guilty to 2 third-degree murder charges for both teens, as well as 4 counts of attempted murder for the injured Roxborough teens, as well as gun and conspiracy charges.
He's set to be sentenced in September.
On Thursday, KYW provided an update to a mass shooting case.
Police say they have made an arrest in a mass shooting last year in Grays Ferry that left 4 men dead. Zaki Harrell is charged with murder and numerous other offenses. Police say he was arrested today at a home on the 2200 block of Beechwood Street in West Passyunk. That's a 20-minute walk from the scene of the shooting early on the morning of July 7, 2025. In that incident, 12 people between the ages of 15 and 24 were shot. 3 men, aged 19, 23, and 24, were pronounced dead a short time later at area hospitals. A 4th victim died last month.
Now we'll take a moment to hear from St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Melissa Price Smith.
She recently joined the Dave Glover Show out of Odyssey station KMOX in St. Louis to talk about a wide range of topics, including the psychology of violent criminals, like those accused of the crimes we've just heard about.
I have a weird question for you, and I'm not trying to in any way trap you here or there, but you spent your career dealing with people who commit crimes. And I'm not talking about, they all have beady eyes. Like, is there any commonality that, like, oh, yeah, I see this over and over again, like bad childhoods and this, like... You could go into a sociology class and talk about this.
Yeah, or I could be the subject of a sociology. They could study study my brain.
Right.
No, I think the scariest thing for anybody who does this type of work or who's in any type of law enforcement realizes that there is no commonality.
That's scary.
They look like the rest of us.
That's scary.
Walk amongst us. And I think that's what's the most scary. And, you know, an interesting thing about that question, years ago, when people would ask me when I was doing just the sexual assault cases, they would ask me, does it ever affect you? Does it ever mess you up? And for some reason, I thought in order to appear strong, I would always say no, it doesn't. And in the last few years, I've realized it's not strong to say no. It's strong to say yes. And because of that, we're actually creating a wellness unit in our office, because I realize if I would say no, it doesn't affect me. I realize probably a lot of our young prosecutors feel the same. So now we're creating a wellness unit.
Another recent crime that's made headlines everywhere this past week was the assassination attempt at the White House Correspondents' Dinner last Saturday. For some more insight into Cole Thomas Allen, the 31-year-old arrested crime and terror analyst Brad Garrett joined A New Morning on Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo.
Luckily, Brad, nobody was killed, but this could have been much worse, and we're learning more about the person behind this through images and what's come out in a courtroom. What are you noticing from some of the things that we've learned about this shooter that maybe sounds familiar to you?
So let's start with sort of this shooter as a person. You know, super smart, apparently, a bachelor's degree in engineering, master's degree in computer science, was a tutor to students. Who apparently thought a lot of him. He was considered, you know, kind and humble, et cetera. But he's a great example of, yes, he apparently was those things on the surface, but inside he was seething and in particular angry at the current administration's staff and the decisions they're making in reference to ICE, Iran, Ukraine. His list went on and on. And so if you take that, now obviously there's a lot of people upset with the administration, and that's fine. But no one's going to go do what he attempted to do, basically, except for a few people. And so what happens is that if you look at these common variables, mass shooters tend to be isolated, which apparently he was a super shy. He would eat lunch alone, according to coworkers at this tutoring service. Spent a lot of time online, apparently built video games of some sort. And at some point, his anger and rage then turned to obsession. Then obsession sort of turned to, I feel powerless. I think something needs to be changed. And I'm going to be the one to change it. Totally irrational, of course, but the point being driven. And it's the combination of all of that and 10 other variables I could throw out that sort of drive these people to actually create a plan. Because obviously he had to have a fairly detailed plan. He had to rent a hotel room in advance. He had to get to the hotel without anybody knowing he had weapons, which meant translated into he went by train from Southern California all the way to Washington, D.C. And I'm going to assume he got there a day or so early that he started doing surveillance of how do we get to the ballroom without getting caught. And obviously he found this vulnerable stairwell that was unlocked and his ability to get down it. And, you know, in recent days, the government has released a photograph of him in his, it would appear, his hotel room, but right before the shooting. It doesn't surprise me one bit, because there's a certain part of power here, feeling powerless, but now feeling powerful, and that I'm going to take action. I'm going to do something. And all of that creates the justification in their mind to go and commit these acts. Now, clearly, if he'd have come out of that stairwell with an automatic weapon, we'd be having a different story, sadly, to talk about. Thank goodness that wasn't the case. But I do think he fits many of the variables I just described, and maybe some others, typically, that occurs in mass shooters.
Something else that I think occurs with mass shooters, law enforcement was tipped by his brother in Connecticut shortly after the incident. Is that often the case where family members see something, but it's just a little bit too late when they decide to go to law enforcement?
Yeah. After the act investigation by law enforcement typically turns up sometimes very specific disturbing information that was never passed. Others, it may be less so, and where people are concerned, worried about their relative or loved one, but not concerned that they are going to do something like the act that he attempted to commit. Well, did commit, just wasn't successful. Yes, that's fairly common.
Looking at, you're talking about this shooter, and, you know, compared to someone like Luigi Mangione, who also had written things on the bullets, this shooter had things written on guns. I mean, it seems like they don't really care that much about being caught, and they're just looking to send whatever message they think they're sending.
No doubt. You also have to look at these as suicide missions. I mean, I don't think, Mangione obviously survived and successfully got away from the scene. That wasn't caught until a lot of hours later in Pennsylvania. That this act by them was supposed to be so important and so life-changing for so many people that they were willing to die. So, and that's why many of them do die at the scene. So that's part of it. But that also lets you know how obsessed they are and what they're doing. The level of, I guess, desperation and rage that it is so high that they feel like they just absolutely have to do what they ultimately end up doing.
Before Cole Thomas Allen was caught running through the halls of the Washington, D.C. Hilton during the White House Correspondents' Dinner last Saturday, another crime shocked people in Chicago. According to Block Club Chicago, 26-year-old Alfonso Talley was accused of robbing a Family Dollar store and beating an employee. He was then taken into custody and brought to Swedish Hospital on the city's north side. He had told law enforcement that he swallowed multiple bags of drugs. Talley somehow allegedly managed to hide the gun he used for the robbery while in police custody and as he went through hospital security. Block Club Chicago added that how he did this remains a mystery. As he was getting ready for a CT scan at the hospital, Talley allegedly used the gun to fatally shoot Chicago police officer John Bartholomew and to critically wound Bartholomew's partner. He then allegedly proceeded to run through the hospital, demand car keys from an employee, shoot his way through glass doors, and chase a postal worker in a van before he was seen running naked through the nearby neighborhood. Talley was eventually found hiding under a porch during a manhunt. Records show that Talley has an extensive criminal history and had been on electronic monitoring in the past. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson commented on the case this week. Here's Jeff Buckles of Odyssey Station WBBM News Radio in Chicago reporting.
The first question the mayor fielded during his town hall meeting on Channel 7 was about the record of the suspect in last weekend's death of Officer John Bartholomew.
I'm going to continue to ask that the city of Chicago
continue to pray for the Bartholomew family.
And he went on to say details about the suspect's past were still being unpacked. Those details include a missed court date last month and several failed check-ins with his electronic monitor tied to a previous criminal case. He was asked, is the system broken?
I don't think there's a debate around the penal system, the justice system, and its inability to really hold all of the complexity that exists within our society.
He said the time is always ripe to consider changes to make sure the system treats everyone fairly, but did not name specific changes he felt were needed.
What I'm going to do is focus on the things that I can control,
which he said includes supporting the police department and making sure suspects are held accountable. We're at City Hall. Jeff Buckles.
Buckles also reported on Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's comments on the case, as well as other state politicians.
It's a tragedy what's happened.
And the governor says it could have been avoided if the Cook County judge hearing previous cases against the suspect in Officer Bartholomew's death had paid attention to details of his criminal history and not let him out on electronic monitoring.
The judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
But State Senate Republican leader John Curran joined other GOP lawmakers in Springfield to introduce a proposed change to the law, spelling out that anyone who commits a felony while wearing an ankle monitor must be held behind bars until both cases are closed.
Letting violent offenders out over and over again to commit more violent crimes isn't creating less prisoners. It's creating more victims.
The governor told reporters he has not seen the details of the Republicans' proposal, but repeated that the law as written allows judges to hold potentially violent suspects.
The judge who had the ability to keep the person in jail.
In Wayne County, Michigan, a jury just found another man accused of killing a police officer, Michael Lopez, who was accused of killing Melvindale officer Mohammed Zaid in 2024, guilty.
We, the jury, find the defendant count one first-degree murder of a peace officer or second-degree murder guilty of first-degree murder of a peace officer.
Thank you. You can move on to the next count.
Count two, felon in possession of a firearm, guilty of felon in possession of a firearm. Count three, felon in possession of ammunition, guilty of felon in possession of ammunition. Count four, carrying a concealed weapon, guilty of carrying a concealed weapon. Count five, controlled substance possession of methamphetamine, ecstasy, guilty of controlled substance possession of methamphetamine ecstasy. Count six, controlled substance possession of cocaine less than 25 grams. Guilty of controlled substance possession of cocaine less than 25 grams. Count seven, carrying a dangerous weapon with unlawful intent. Guilty of carrying a dangerous weapon with...
What you're hearing now is courtroom coverage from Odyssey Station WWJ News Radio in Detroit.
Would you like me to pull the jury?
Yes, please. Please, Your Honor.
Juror in seat number one, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes, it is.
Juror in seat number two, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number three, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number five, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number seven, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number eight, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number nine, was that and is that your verdict?
Yes.
Juror in seat number 10, was that and is that your verdict?
Lopez's sentencing is set for May 22nd. He could face life in prison without the possibility of parole. He's not facing a possible death penalty, in part because Michigan does not have the death penalty, along with 22 other U.S. states, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. A few states away, death penalty sentences are on pause in Pennsylvania. Lawmakers there are considering ending the practice permanently. Here's Odyssey Station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia to explain.
KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melwort reports.
Philadelphia Democrat Chris Robb says the criminal justice system's not perfect, and as long as there can be wrongful convictions, there should be no death penalty.
There are no takebacks here. It's irreversible. It is expensive. And our government does not have the moral authority to put people to death.
In addition to Rob's bill, the State House Judiciary Committee also advanced a similar bill from Republican Russ Diamond, who notes Pennsylvania hasn't carried out an execution since 1999, but with built-in appeals, the costs of a death penalty conviction are significantly higher than life in prison.
A life sentence without the possibility of parole is a harsh penalty and tough justice. Continuing to pursue the death penalty is a moral minefield riddled with far too many flaws and excessive expense for taxpayers.
Both bills advanced, but on the same party line vote, with all Democrats on the committee in favor and all Republicans opposed. Despite the partisan vote, Rob says he's confident there's enough Republican support in both chambers to get the bill to the governor's desk.
Even if suspects are convicted and sentenced, that doesn't mean that all the evidence brought against them is irrefutable. For example, Steve Neivlings has revealed in his reporting that coerced statements have plagued the Detroit justice system. Here's Neivlings' breakdown of his investigation into the matter from an interview with Daryl and Horn of WWJ News Radio.
So what CNN did was essentially re-report what I wrote in a two-part series in 2024, and they outlined what I had reported, which is that Barbara Simon is a retired Detroit homicide detective, and she is responsible for at least 8 people so far being released from prison because of unlawful tactics like getting coerced interviews and false confessions and putting innocent black men in prison for decades. So the story followed what has happened, all the allegations against her, and then what has happened since. And the interesting part is, since that series ran, just in the past month, the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office released 2 victims of Barbara Simon. So we're starting to see some progress in those cases. It's taken 2 years, but the families are very happy that something is finally happening. So CNN just put a big spotlight on this case nationally, and I think that sort of adds to the pressure that's facing prosecutors and police to investigate Barbara Simon's tactics for 2 decades that landed a lot of people who are innocent behind bars. Okay, so she retired in 2010, so she must have been there about 1990 and 2010, and at one point, she was the head of the homicide division for the Detroit Police Department, and she was able to get confessions and witness statements that other police officers were not able to get. We later found out that was because of coerced confessions and coerced witness statements, but she was so effective at getting these statements that they called her the closer. The problem was a lot of those statements were not actual statements. They were written by her. And the suspects in these cases were accused of murders, and they ended up falsely confessing, hoping that they would get out of jail and be able to argue their case. And she made false promises to get them to do that. And as a result, they ended up spending decades and decades behind bars for murders they never committed.
Which is so sad, because what does she gain?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sad part. It's in the late 1990s, there was a lot of pressure on the prosecutor. There's a lot of pressure on the Detroit Police Department to secure convictions, because Detroit was sort of becoming a laughingstock. The murder conviction rate was really low. So there was a lot of pressure put on the police department to try to get these convictions. The only problem is they were getting convictions, but they weren't paying attention to whether or not those were real convictions or false convictions. And what we later found out is a lot of these people actually were innocent. And what they would do when there was a murder in the late 90s and early 2000s is they would, if there was a murder on a single block in Detroit, they would take almost everybody on that block who lives on that block who could have been a possible eyewitness, and they would arrest them, and they would take them downtown, and then they would threaten them. So if any of them had previous charges, or if police knew they had something else on them, they would threaten them unless they were able to identify a suspect. And oftentimes they encouraged them to identify a certain suspect. And that's how they were able to get that closure rate back up, that conviction rate back up. But as a result, unfortunately, many, many of those people who ended up in prison were innocent. And the thing that was really sad about this is in the 1990s and early 2000s, the Justice Department came and investigated the Detroit Police Department, and they honed in on the homicide department. And what they found was the exact same thing, that there were interrogations taking place that weren't being recorded. People were falsely confessing. And the city signed a consent agreement with the Justice Department, but nobody ever thought to go back and look at all the people who were convicted during that period. So when I went back at that period and looked at it, there were a lot of people who have very similar stories about either falsely confessing or witnesses being coerced or threatened in order to pinpoint a suspect. And oftentimes those cases unraveled later in appeals courts. But, you know, there's still a lot of people who are behind bars who say Barbara Simon did the exact same thing to them. In fact, I'm having a story come out tomorrow listing about 20 more people who are still in prison for murder, even though they say they're innocent. And all of them say they were victimized by Barbara Simon.
You said at least 20?
Yeah, oh, at least 20.
Gosh.
Yeah, I talked to all 20 of them.
Oh,
yep.
My gosh.
And they're still in prison. And the sad thing is, this, I have focused on probably before that about a dozen to 20 people who are still in prison prior to this, that as a result of Barbara Simon. And none of those people have received a call from the prosecutor's office saying their cases are reviewed. So there's a lot of concern that the people who've been cooperating with this story to help shed light on it are the ones who are going to stay behind bars because they helped blow the whistle on this. So there's a lot of concern about that. The two people who were recently released were not people that I talked to. So these additional 20 that I am going to reveal tomorrow, you know, they're hoping that some exposure is going to bring them justice. And, you know, only time will tell, but it's been almost 2 years, and so far only two people have been released.
So Kim Worthy is another name I keep hearing about when it comes to these what do you call them, exonerating or convictions.
Yeah.
Like she's accused of not looking into these cases when she said she would, and just kind of giving people false hope. What do you say to that?
Yeah, this has been an interesting journey dealing with the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, because on one hand, you have a lot of people who say they're innocent, and families have been begging them to meet with her. And when my series first ran, she said they would meet with the families, but she never did end up meeting with them. So a lot of the families are really frustrated. You know, they know what happened to their loved one. They know that the circumstances are very similar to what happened with Barbara Simon. So the prosecutor's office ended up getting a grant in order to assemble a team in their innocence department. And they started looking at these cases full-time probably about a year ago. The issue is it takes a really long time to go through those cases to determine who's innocent and who's not, because you don't want to put you know, someone who did commit a murder back on the street. So the prosecutor's office is starting to do something, but the families still feel that the prosecutor's office isn't going fast enough, because this was, in fact, a prosecutor's office's problem. They knew that Barbara Simon had been getting these false confessions and allowed it to continue and fought to keep these men behind bars.
What do you feel like the CNN article could do at this point?
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, it's a national platform. What do you think is going to come from it?
Yeah, I think that CNN covering this is going to bring more attention to what happened in Detroit. Oftentimes, and it's sad, is that you need local and national coverage in order to get the justice system to work properly. And in these cases, you need judges, prosecutors, police, all to get involved in this and make a real concerted effort to find out who is innocent
and get them out of prison, because we know that so far 8 people have been released as a result of this. But what is happening to all the others? I mean, I think we've counted now more than 30 who are still in prison, still waiting. And I talked to many of them, and I think everyone I talked to said they have not heard a single word from the prosecutor's office. So they're really worried that their case is not going to get a serious review. But I think what this does is put pressure on the right folks to do the right thing this time, since it was really egregiously messed up the last time.
Yeah, that's some progress, but we'll have to see what comes of it. So I know you mentioned that there was going to be some new information coming out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you could tell us right now what we're going to see?
20 additional people who are still in prison and say they were victimized by Barbara Simon. All of them have almost the exact same story. They said they were accused of a murder. They were taken downtown. They were denied a lawyer. They were denied a phone call. And then they were told that they had enough evidence against these suspects that they might as well sign a confession by Barbara Simon that she wrote herself in hopes of getting second degree murder and to get out of jail until the trial started. Well, none of that actually happened. Every single one of them who confessed never got out of jail, and they never got to make their phone call that they're entitled to, never got access to an attorney until they confessed. So these are people who have been waiting and waiting, who've been denied time and time again by the same courts, denied and denied again by the same prosecutors, and these people desperately want a review of their case. They're not asking to just be released. They're just asking for prosecutors to take a closer look, for judges to take a closer look. And I think now that we know that many of these confessions have been coerced, if any of these cases were before a jury now, Barbara Simon's words would have no credit, no credibility. And the issue with this is, in most of these cases, there's no forensic evidence. It's only Barbara Simon's word against the murder suspects. And these murder suspects have the exact same story. So they're eerily the same. And I'm so worried that we still have men who are in prison 2-3 decades and have lost their family members and desperately want to get out, and they're just getting no relief. And it's really sad.
Throughout the country, there are law enforcement agencies, lawmakers, and policymakers striving to make the justice system work better for victims and for those accused. Here's a bit of St. Louis prosecuting attorney Melissa Price Smith's interview with Dave Glover at KMOX in St. Louis to end our show today.
What was it like going from 19 years of working your way up to being the boss? That had to be kind of weird.
It was extremely weird. And the majority of those years, although I did all types of crime, the majority of those years, I prosecuted sexual assault and child abuse cases. So those cases were my heart. I mean, they still are. It was an honor to work on those cases with the victims were the bravest people that I've ever met. So I really thought that I would work on those type of cases for the rest of my career. So the day I was sworn in, January 3rd of 25, we reinstated our violent crime unit that afternoon. Very, very proud of that. And that is the number one step we had to take. That unit had been suspended 2 years before, but we had to take that step in order to get violent offenders off the streets. We also created a homicide unit. We have 270 pending homicide cases in our office right now. So we created a homicide unit. We recruited 4 veteran prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office to come to our office and help us build that homicide unit and train our young lawyers.
Yeah.
We created a hospital violence unit. I had not realized, I was taught by a very special nurse who was a victim on one of my cases a few years ago, that our healthcare workers are assaulted quite frequently. About 55% of healthcare workers report being assaulted on the job. But for years, it has been seen as a job hazard. So we created a dedicated hospital violence unit to protect our healthcare workers and hold those accountable who think it's okay to assault healthcare workers. We also expanded our sexual assault child abuse unit. It's now called Special Victims Unit because under that umbrella, we now included elder abuse. Those cases also need a specialized team. They need specialized attention.
Yeah. Both vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely. We have created a cold case unit because we're very aware that cases go unsolved. There are victims, there are families and victims out there that they don't have the closure. So we look at cold cases in cooperation with police departments because we want to bring, though, even if it's been years, 10, 20, 30 years, we still want to bring those families closure. We have also increased our treatment court and diversion. We've doubled it. We've doubled the amount of attorneys that work in those areas because we know how very important it truly is. And we have increased our community outreach 1,000%. The more we get out into the community and talk and listen, the better community we'll have. And we also speak to high schools a lot. I think the more we speak to young people, if we can help one young person avoid ever being in the criminal justice system, it's worth it.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WWJ News Radio in Detroit, KNX News in Los Angeles, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, KRLD 1080 in Dallas, The Dave Glover Show out of KMOX in St. Louis, A New Morning out of WBEN News Talk in Buffalo, and WBBM News Radio in Chicago. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.